1881, Down House, England.
Charles, look. Oh. This issue of Punch has a poem entitled The Worm Turns.
Oh?
They seemed like your book.
Perhaps Leonard will be kind enough to read it to
you. Certainly, Father. I'll read it to you. I've despised you, old worm, for I think you'll admit that you never were beautiful, even in youth. I've impaled you on hooks and not felt it a bit. But all's changed now that Darwin has told us the truth of your diligent life and endowed you with fame. You begin to inspire me with kindly regard. I have friends of my own, clever worm I could name, who have ne'er in their lives been at work half so hard. It appears that we owe you our acres of soil, that the garden could never exist without you, that from ages gone by you were patient in toil, till a Darwin revealed all the good that you do. Now you've turned with a vengeance, and all must confess your behavior should make poor humanity squirm. For there's many a man on this planet, I guess, who is not half so useful as you, Mr. Worm.
Worms do not possess any sense of hearing. They took not the least notice of the shrill notes from a mental whistle, which was repeatedly sounded near them. Nor did they of the deepest and loudest tones of a bassoon. They were indifferent to shouts. If care was taken that the breath did not strike them. When placed on a table close to the keys of a piano, which was played as loudly as possible, they remained perfectly quiet. Although they are indifferent to undulations, audible by us, they are extremely sensitive to vibrations in any solid object. When the pots containing two worms, which had remained quite indifferent to the sound of the piano, were placed on this instrument, and the note C in the bass clef was struck, both instantly retreated into their burrows. After a time, they emerged, and when G above the line in the treble clef was struck, they again retreated. Under a similar circumstance, on another night, one worm dashed into its burrow on a very high note being struck only once, and the other worm when C in the treble clef was struck. On these occasions, the worms were not touching the sides of the pots, which stood in saucers, so that the vibrations, before reaching their bodies, had to pass from the sounding board of the piano through the saucer, the bottom of the pot, and the damp, not very compact earth on which they lay with their tails in their burrows. They often showed their sensitiveness when the pot in which they lived, or the table on which the pot stood, was accidentally and lightly struck. But they appeared less sensitive to such jars than to the vibrations of the piano. And their sensitiveness to jars varied much at different times. It has often been said that if the ground is beaten, or otherwise made to tremble, worms believe that they are pursued by a mole and leave their burrows. I beat the ground in many places where worms abounded, but not one emerged. When, however, the ground is dug with a fork and is violently disturbed beneath a worm, it will often crawl quickly out of its burrow. The whole body of a worm is sensitive to contact. A slight puff of air from the mouth causes an instant retreat. The glass plates placed over the pots did not fit closely, and blowing through the very narrow chinks thus left often sufficed to cause a rapid retreat. They sometimes perceived the eddies in the air caused by quickly removing the glass plates. When a worm first comes out of its burrow, It generally moves the much extended anterior extremity of its body from side to side in all directions, apparently as an organ of touch. And there is some reason to believe, as we shall see in the next chapter, that they are thus enabled to gain a general notion of the form of an object. Of all their senses, that of touch, including in this term the perception of a vibration, seems much the most highly developed. In worms, the sense of smell apparently is confined to the perception of certain odours and is feeble. They were quite indifferent to my breath. With the higher animals, when close attention to some object leads to the disregard of the impressions which other objects must be producing on them, we attribute this to their attention being then absorbed. And attention implies the presence of a mind. Every sportsman knows that he can approach animals when they are grazing, fighting, or courting much more easily than at other times. The state, also, of the nervous system of the higher animals differs much at different times. For instance, a horse is much more readily startled at one time than at another. The comparison here implied between the actions of one of the higher animals and of one so low on the scale as an earthworm may appear far-fetched. For we thus attribute to the worm attention and some mental power. Nevertheless, I can see no reason to doubt the justice of the comparison.
And more
of sin. The horror, the soul of the plot. A crawling shape intrude, a blood-red thing that writhes from out its scenic solitude. It writhes with mortal pangs. The mimes become its food, and seraphs sob it vermin fangs in human gore imbued. Out, out are the lights. Out, and over each quivering form, the curtain of funeral pain comes down with the rush of a storm. Angels, all pallid and wan, uprising, unveiling, affirm. That the play's the tragedy, man, and its hero, the conqueror worm, and its hero, the conqueror worm.